All literature is gossip. You are listening to Filthy Armenian Adventures.
When a bee lies sleeping in the palm of your hand, you're bewitched and deep in love's long looked after land, where you'll see with a morning new, and where the days go laughing by as love comes a calling on you. Sleep on, bee, don't wake up. Just past, he's mine for the taking. I am happy at last. Maybe I dreams, but he seems sweet golden as a crown.
We have them like that in the Soviet Union, but we hide them.
That's what someone from the Ministry of Culture said after witnessing a grand, twirling exit through the revolving doors of the Leningrad Astoria by Truman Capote. Born in New Orleans 100 years ago, Truman Capote, the only child of a fraudulent traveling salesman and a glamour-chasing alcoholic mother who didn't just abandon him, but who raised him in a state of ceaseless abandonment. The father chasing riches never found, the mother hunting new men for weeks at a time, coming back for an afternoon, ditching town again that night, the child never knowing when she'd be back. The father abandoned him once. The mother never stopped abandoning him. She even found a way of doing it in death, by killing herself. That final abandonment from which there is no recovery and no relief of guilt and no chance to right it away. She committed suicide. His stepfather was chill. Joe Capote. He seemed like a decent guy. Until he, too, was destroyed by Nina. Capote learned how to tell stories at a very early age, winning contests with his earliest work, making a name for himself in the little town of Monroeville, Alabama. Population 1800, where his best friend was Harper Lee, To Kill a Mockingbird. He made a name for himself at The New Yorker when he was only a teen running errands in the office. They didn't publish anything he wrote until later, but he made a name for himself. He snooped around, chaperoned James Thurber to get pussy from his mistress. He became the talk of the town. On a self-appointed assignment for the talk of the town, he attended a Robert Frost reading and appeared so bored during that reading that Frost closed his book, threw it away, and left the room. And that's when The New Yorker fired Truman Capote. He'd be back, not in their offices, but in their pages. Capote kept on making a name for himself. He was becoming writer famous before his first novel even appeared, on the strength of a couple short stories and a nation's desire to look for talent after the war. Those stories appeared in Harper's Bazaar and Mademoiselle, which were not literary magazines, but magazines of women's fashion. They both had incredible literary sections, thanks to editors of Titanic Taste and Vision and Near Total Freedom, to exercise that vision toward publishing the very finest and most exciting fiction they could find. It was a perfect time for a talented writer to be alive. Capote's first novel, published when he was 24, is called Other Voices, Other Rooms. It is a decadent Southern Gothic tale about a very effeminate 13-year-old boy who goes looking for his estranged father after his mother dies in New Orleans, encounters a carnival of queer and eccentric characters along the way, and finally discovers that his father is a mute paraplegic locked up in a mansion who only communicates by dropping red tennis balls. The novel's dazzling style and visual appetite made more waves than the fact that it was a thinly disguised coming to homo biography. Said Truman later on, "I now realize that what I was attempting with Other Voices, Other Rooms was to exorcise my own devils, the subterranean anxieties that dominated my feelings and imagination. And my ignorance of this was probably a protective shield between me and the subconscious wellspring of my material." The gothic grotesque veneer of that protective shield would turn out to be a prophecy. The first novel was a decent success, and Truman continued to make a name for himself. He wrote more stories, he met more and more people, he charmed them all, seemed to be a fixture of some kind in every single American celebrity's life, and many non-American celebrities. When the government decided to launch Porgy and Bess at the USSR, not as a weapon of war, but as a mission of diplomatic goodwill in the 50s, Truman joined the troop along with a bunch of other celebrities and chronicled the attack for The New Yorker, resulting in the book The Muses Are Heard. He wrote screenplays, he wrote plays, he wrote musicals in the 50s. He wrote Breakfast at Tiffany's, making big money, even if he really preferred his good friend Marilyn Monroe to his good friend Audrey Hepburn for the part. "Would have been a very easy thing to laugh at him had it been anyone except Truman," said the great director John Huston about meeting him at a party by Bennett Cerf. "I immediately fell for him. It didn't take me 5 minutes to be won over completely, as he did with everyone I ever saw him encounter. He had a charm that was, to coin a phrase, ineffable." Huston would later hire him to write the script for the Beat the Devil, starring Humphrey Bogart, who challenged Capote, as he called him, to an arm wrestling match on set and lost. They became real tight after that. "He was a bulldog," Huston would say. "Truman was a little bulldog of a man." But the bulldog did not find the bone his literary career was looking for to make his name for all time, until one day, while digging through the New York Times, he sniffed out the headline, "Wealthy Farmer, Three of Family Slain." Truman Capote was off to Kansas. After 6 years, he would tell the story of that murder in the form of a nonfiction novel. This had more voices and more rooms than any project he had undertaken. The other voices of the murdered Cutter family and the murderers Dick Hickok and Perry Smith. The other rooms of Holcomb, Kansas, and of prison. Capote relied only on his ears, ditching tape recorder and using a notepad only after his interviews were over to transcribe what he heard. Through endless visits and letters, he got to know the murderers especially well, narrating not only their exterior but their interior lives. But before he could make them lasting characters in American literature, he had to wait until their story officially ended. He had to watch each of them hang from the noose for 30 minutes until the life was squeezed out. In Cold Blood, dropped in 1966 in 4 issues of The New Yorker that everybody read. In protest of everybody reading In Cold Blood, the Pulitzer that year went to David Brian Davis's The Problem of Slavery in Western Culture. Nevertheless, In Cold Blood was a sensation and a pioneering work in what would be called new journalism, blending reportage with fictional technique. But while other new journalists like Tom Wolfe or Hunter Thompson would become famous for inserting themselves in their reportage, the one person completely absent from In Cold Blood is Truman Capote. To celebrate his crowning achievement in 7 years of hard work, Truman Capote threw the black and white ball. Anybody who was anybody desperately wanted an invite to that night at the Plaza. No American writer had been so famous since Ernest Hemingway and before that Mark Twain, and neither one of them had anything like television to promote their name. No writer, American or otherwise, can ever be that famous again. In 1966, other voices, other rooms could not stop echoing the name of Truman Capote. It was all downhill from there. A new season of Ryan Murphy's feud, Capote versus the Swans, chronicles the grotesque, miserable downhill. It depicts Capote's friendship with the ultra-high society ladies known as the Swans, about whose world he had dreamed of writing his last big book, a Proustian effort that had possessed him ever since he thought of the title Answered Prayers. Answered Prayers became a vortex decorated with booze and pills and obsession that swallowed him whole. He could never complete the book or understand what it was he was trying to write. And this time, booze and pills cut off contact with that spectral dictator that communicated his first novel to him, the one about his search for his father. Was it because the search was now for his mother, from whom there was no shield to protect him? Was it because literary success achieved at the cost of watching life choked out of two men fried the spirit it takes to sit down and figure things out on the page? Truman was not in Kansas anymore. Desperate for answers and affirmation, he released a chapter of the work in progress in Esquire magazine under the title Lecote Basque, and it spilled all kinds of fully recognizable beans about his girlfriends and their husbands. They immediately cut him off from their circles, and the spiral proceeded full speed. By 1984, Truman Capote had had all of life he could handle. To paraphrase John Huston, it would be a very easy thing to laugh at Truman Capote if one forgot that his talent was almost supernatural, if one ignored his generosity and recognition of the beauty of the aggressively average male, if one overlooked his courage and strength and unwillingness to pander, if one didn't know that his literary judgments, even involving his closest friends and enemies, were always sharp as a knife. It would be a very easy thing to look at him with the same bewilderment we look with now at Charles Manson or Ted Bundy or any number of histrionic faggots that some glitch in history made people believe were charming. It would also be a very easy thing to cry for Truman Capote as a victim of alcoholism or childhood abandonment or two wildly shitty parents, of celebrity culture, of being too gay or too little or whatever. A sort of aromatic, illusionary enigma hangs over the life of Truman Capote, and it won't let go. Nominal determinism has never been so proud. You could not imagine a more appropriate name for Truman Capote, the new journalist who made a name for himself, than Truman Capote. Unless, of course, you wanted to add his birth name to the one his mother found for him and his stepfather, and call him Truman Persons Capote. This being an LA-based program, I am finally impelled to mention that when Truman Capote died in 1984, the city he miserably died in was Los Angeles. A city which always treated him warmly, always treated him generously, respected and admired him at his weirdest, not just at his most popular. A city in which his last best friend, Joanne Carson, resided with always open arms. A city which, like his good friend Marilyn, Truman Capote hated. Surprise, surprise. But who can be surprised that the genius of other voices, other rooms, hated the city where you can come to escape the cold, you can come to escape the past, you can come to escape the silence or the noise. But where the only thing you can't ever escape is yourself. Hey everyone, it's your host Alec Mohibian with a quick note before we begin. Filthy Armenian Adventures is an interdimensional travel program that takes you deep into the cultural mysteries of our strange and interesting times. In search of truth, in search of gold, in search of lost friends and unsung heroes, in search of John Galt's motor. The show is supported entirely by patrons at patreon.com/filthyarmenian. Patrons get access to twice as many adventures, including the most intimate and scandalous ones, plus regular 5 to 15 minute smoke break mini episodes on movies, shows, and topics of the urgent moment. Patrons also get first dibs on our next live event. The first two were a smash. It's very easy to keep Filthy Armenian Adventures alive. You can still listen to the premium feed on Apple or Spotify or your favorite app, and you can do so with the pride that you're putting a little bit of money where your soul is. More patrons means more landmarks, more hotspots, more secret locations and forbidden territories around the world, and the world that is Los Angeles, our apocalyptic headquarters. It means we'll be able to track down more enchanting figures in the landscape and dare them to abandon their masks. Patreon.com/filthyarmenian. Gracias for listening, and enjoy the show.
And like a kiss being blown, we are on the air with Jack Mason of the Perfume Nationalist and Adam Lehr of Safety Propaganda.
And we're going to be talking about Truman Capote, the life of Truman Capote, the work of Truman Capote. I wanted to do this last year. I remember reaching out to Jack, and then like the next day, I saw that there was going to be a feud coming out this year. And so I decided to sit on it until this year, until this feud show came out. In case you haven't heard, it's called Feud. It's on Hulu, FX. It's called Feud, Capote versus the Swans. It's the Ryan Murphy franchise, although Ryan Murphy did not direct it or write it. It's written, much of it is directed by Gus Van Sant and written by whoever. And we're going to talk about that as well, but we're not only going to talk about that. I watched the series. I finished it actually today because it was so hard to finish. The last several episodes were so fucking painful.
Brutal.
I started off being like, ooh la la, we've got this.
Totally.
Ooh, it's elegant and cinematic and the literary scene. And ooh,
They could have ended at the episode at the ball. That's where
when you thought it was over at the fourth episode, that they should have just killed it right there.
Yeah, there was.
This is a problem with new shows that keeps popping up that no one knows when they end, and the ending is usually really bad, but there's so much confusion about like when a show ends because everything is dropped so invisibly onto your devices.
What's weird also is that the series are like, everything is like short compared to the past, you know, like even like the longest series now is like 12 episodes. The longest season, I should say, is like 12 episodes. And
we are also joined by Zach Langley Chi-Chi of Tokyo, Japan.
Morning.
Sorry, I'm late. I couldn't find my earbuds, but I'm here now.
He's joined us now. Better late than never, silly.
Okay. I really cannot hear the Truman Capote voice ever again. Yeah, don't do any impressions of it, please. I can't hear it.
Now I know.
I really wanted to peel my skin off. I mean, it really is like a hindrance to watching the show.
Here's the problem.
And he kind of hammed it reading up his too. Shit. Like, it's hard to listen to.
You know, it's interesting because, like, I like the Philip Seymour Hoffman depiction of him was a bit more sober or like a bit more.
It was way better. It was way
better. Way better. A bit more emphatic of his depth. This show sort of alluded to the depth, but like couldn't help but go for the clown mode depiction of him for the majority.
I feel like this show is very deceptive. And I after watching this show, I'm very angry, just to be honest with you. There's obviously much to be annoyed by Truman Capote, but this show is almost like the most, it's like the most devious thing they could have ever done to him. And
wait, but you already knew that it was bad by the time you started watching it, right? Because watching it as they were coming out, it seemed like it was good for a while.
No, I didn't know it was bad yet. I did not know it was bad. You did not tip me off that it got really bad. So I actually was like, I started watching it. I was into it relatively, you know, because it was like, well, it's very slickly made. It's very cinematic. It's very fancy without being too fancy. It's fancy in a non-glossy way in the beginning, in the first four episodes. It has a great credit sequence. That credit title sequence is excellent. You know, it's very like dramatic and operatic. But the problem is, if you have any idea, like, why Truman Capote was so popular and so successful and so interesting and entertaining. Like my beginning of this journey, I started by reading Conversations with Truman Capote before the show, like right around the time the show started playing. And I hadn't been watching it. I was reading Conversations with Truman Capote, which is like a book of, you know, a couple long interviews stitched together from the 80s, like from his late phase. And I laughed so much reading that book that I'm not talking about just like laughing on the inside. I'm talking about I out loud physically laughed at least a dozen times, which does not happen when you read a book anymore. It's like not a thing anymore. It was so funny. And I'm like, oh my God, no wonder he was such and this is late. This is fucking drug addled Capote. I guess he was probably sober and in good spirits during the actual interviews of that book. And when you watch the show, this is just him going off the cuff, okay? But when you watch the show, there's zero evidence that he was funny. There's zero evidence that he was witty. There's zero evidence that he was like really brilliant, except in this like, you know, comical, gay, villain, devious way. It's the most like I would be afraid for Ryan Murphy's fate at this point, because Capote was known to try and kill the people who wronged him, the gay people who wronged him, and like hunt them down and break their legs and hire assassins and shit. All of this was not in the show, but this is what he actually tried to do to that Irish guy that he fell in love with. If Capote's ghost is out there, he is going to fucking hunt down Ryan Murphy for this show. This is a absolutely, like, this is a libelously horrific depiction of Truman Capote at his, like, the worst version you could possibly imagine.
I don't agree. I think the first four episodes are good. I think that it takes a turn, and it's basically split into two halves, which is a format and a formula that they do. Like, it follows the same format as the Dahmer one, where they front load it with the good stuff.
Yeah,
that's largely free of editorial comment, and it gives you what you want. Like, shows Dahmer getting drunk alone and killing guys, shows Capote just being a villainous gay, and he's totally in the wrong, and all the women are interesting and good. And then, in order to cover all the bases, at the midway point of the show, they bring in the intersectional perspective really overbearingly to say, oh, actually, let's examine the relative privilege of all of the characters. Fortunately, that's the low point of the show, is that James Baldwin episode that relates to nothing at all. It stays bad for the rest of the series, but it never gets that bad again. But I think that the first four of them are really good.
And yeah, they're good if you don't, if you discount the fact that, like, I mean, in a vacuum, they're fine. I think they're good too. I just think that as a document of who he was, they present a very incomplete picture that gives you, like, that mystifies you as to why he was so coveted, his company was so coveted in the first place. You know, I think, like,
I think that they do a kind of they attempt an imitation of his, like, wit, you know, at least the stuff in, like, Answered Prayers and Breakfast at Tiffany's that I've read is more or less that type of thing. Of course, the real thing is filled with, like, racism and N-words and that kind of observation. But that, like, she was being fucked by a rhinoceros, and, you know, word has it that he had the biggest dick ever. Like, that is what he is. Right.
Well, that's what he is when he's being the drunk villainous gay, but he was more than that, is my point, I guess. And
I think this is well after his masterwork. He's kind of by the 70s, he had already done, he's like established as a literary icon with the success of In Cold Blood, and he's drunk most of the time, and he's suffering writer's block, and he kind of remaining relevant, you know, becomes this presence on the social scene. And I think we are supposed to kind of see him as not necessarily washed up, but starting to show decline in his mental faculties, but, you know, still with like glimpses of brilliance, but you know, he's just one of those motherfuckers who got in his own way. And the Baldwin episode, I mean, it's not that I have a, like, him and Baldwin did have like a public frenemy thing going on. You know, they made comments about each other's work. But the idea that James Baldwin came to him like a guardian angel and was like, you are actually taking on the ruling class and you must finish this. Like, we all know this shit didn't happen.
Abominable.
It's completely fake. It's so fake.
And zero chance of this happening.
It's also the complete opposite of what he would have done. Like, he was not a leftist.
No. I think he did have a bit of a class resentment, but it was a jealousy. It wasn't like, I want to abolish this. It was because, like, he came from dirt. His mom had this highly coveted aristocratic wealth, and he did have a chip on his shoulder about this shit, but it wasn't like directed or ideological. It was very personal.
It was personal. Go ahead, Zach.
I just want to say, I kind of got a horrible impression of Truman Capote from the last week trying him out. I liked In Cold Blood quite a bit. But then as I was reading it, I started like discovering this really terrible affectation that kind of made me allergic, where, you know, you're sitting and like reading him, imagining like the conversations like the killers have with like people they pick up on the street. And there's kind of this performative style about the way he imagines things that he wasn't present for, inferred off of his research. And by the time I downloaded Answered Prayers onto my Kindle and like read two pages, I was so allergic to him that I like I deleted it off my Kindle. I didn't want it there anymore.
It's torturous.
Nobody it's torturous. Was meant to heinous. See.
I read 400 pages of Proust in the time that it took me to read the 200 pages of Answered Prayers, because it's it like puts you in a bad mood because it's so like malignant and just like it's uncomfortable to read because it's clearly someone's like high on their own supply, like shitty kind of drug porn fantasy.
Mm.
And it's just not good.
It really scared me. I was like,
it's scary.
Yeah, I was like thinking about, you know, my own quote writing unquote or whatever. And then it's like, oh my God, it's the abject mirror. You look into this book and you see like every possible thing that could go wrong by trying to produce anything. It was like horrible timing in my own output of stuff. It scared the shit out of me. It made me want to delete everything and like hide in a cave. Where there are no other gay people.
Yeah.
I first read In Cold Blood for AP English class in high school. And to be honest, that book completely blew my mind.
It blew everybody's mind.
Yeah, it's just like a mind-blowing read. And it's still very shocking, the take that he took, that he had, and the relationships he formed with these guys. And, you know, he pioneered a whole subgenre. Like, there's two, I finally am right now working on something that's sort of in the true crime mold. So I went back to In Cold Blood recently because it's like the archetype. And, God, my two favorite, it's one of my two, it's that one and Gary Indiana's book on Andrew Cunanan are the two true crime books that I love the most. They're both by gay men, which is interesting. But the way Truman Cope, like he worked on In Cold Blood for like almost a decade. And the way that he sort of builds a narrative based on the skeletal notes that he has, most of the book is inference or contemplation or narrative building. But it also still is like completely the truth in one way or another. And I think if he had a gift, it was an observation of the unspoken, like things that we could all measurably see. He was able to extrapolate grandiose truths from. And yeah, it's cool.
When the James Baldwin episode happened, and I couldn't believe like they were actually, I was like, oh my God, is that when I first heard the voice on that, when James Baldwin calls him, that's where you first get it. And he says, and it's in that over the top, like intellectual black voice on the thing. And I'm like, oh no, is this James Baldwin that they're going to fucking airdrop into the show? Sure enough,
I kind of knew he was going to be in it eventually, to be honest.
Well, it's complete. I immediately thought of these lines years ago. I read in some essay about what one famous writer said about James Baldwin. It was, quote, and I'll never, I remember these and I looked them up, and it was, quote, his fiction is crudely written and of a balls aching boredom. And generally, the same writer said, quote, he is a mysterious mixture of real talent and real fraud. And that kind of stuck with me because that was my impression of him. Anyway, the person who wrote that is Truman Capote. So the least they could do, and I think that was in one of his letters, which are published in a book called Too Brief a Treat, which are a collection of his letters.
Did you just say Too Brief a Treat?
Too Brief a Treat.
No, I can't read that.
Well, that's something that he described.
Covers with high heels on them also make it really hard.
Too Brief a Treat is how he described a letter he received from a friend of his or whatever.
No, I can't. I actually like James Baldwin, which I feel bad about, but because he's kind of like incesty. And I like Giovanni's Room, which is like, I don't know. I don't have a problem with him. He's just kind of annoying on this show as this like celestial it's kind of funny. It goes all the way around to actually being like racist, I guess, because it's like the magical Negro like archetype appears to like save Truman Capote, and the depiction of him is like so ethereal and lit with this like yucky yellow lighting so that he seems like some sort of angel. It's really abhorrent.
One of the problems with this weird length of TV show now, where it's both too long and too short, is that this one especially makes you watch everything multiple times. You have to watch them all die multiple times. You have to watch Truman get told what amazing talent he has by a boyfriend who cares about him so much, and how he must stop drinking and throw a glass at the wall like at least four times. And I was like, how many boyfriends does this guy have?
Not many. Not many. That was another fake thing that they just ripped out of thin air.
So many people. It's such gay wish fulfillment. Like, the whole second half of this is gay wish fulfillment, because as Amanda pointed out on my show, the idea that these women would be so attached to this relationship with this toad that it haunts them their entire life, and they're like not thinking about their family or themselves or anything. They're just like, I miss Truman. That's ridiculous.
Yeah,
that's,
it is absurd. Ridiculous.
Well, and they could have gotten back with him if they wanted. But yeah, that's every gay guy's female friend oriented gay guy's fantasy is like, she's going to regret this. What I gave her when we were kikiing in her boudoir was better than anything, you know.
But just so you know, the point here that I have to stress, because it's like, you're going to come away, if you take this as a nonfiction show, this is a fictional show. This is a show that's really fast and loose with all the facts. There's a lot of inaccuracies in this show. I'm not the type of person who's like, oh, this wasn't perfect, I found it logic of entertainment. But this is presented as a biographical thing, and there's so much in this show that's just straight up fake. And the wish fulfillment that I see is the kind of thing you expect out of Ryan Murphy. Like, as Bret Easton Ellis said, a little Ryan Murphy-ish. That's what I see. I see all of these like Ryan Murphy-isms transposed onto Truman Capote as if they were his imagination. He did not bounce around from guy to guy. His problem was he was obsessively attached to the three men in his life he ever had an attachment to.
Shows him attached to, like, obsessively attached to, be like, he won't leave any of them alone.
Yeah, that's exactly who was his problem. Like, that's what drove him crazy.
Every single thing, but
huh?
Not no, to like I mean, argue with every single point you're making, but
no. I mean, I'm just saying, like, there's a sense that he's like randomly picking up people from, from like at the bathhouse and whatever. But that was always when he was like devastatingly heartbroken from his long-term ex. The first time when he picks up the guy in the bathhouse who ends up becoming basically his downfall, it's because Jack Dunphy no longer wanted to have sex with him. And then he picks up this guy. His whole attraction is how average he is. He's like a vice president of a bank. He's described by everyone as aggressively average build wise, facially. And that's his whole kind of appeal. He wants to be a writer, so that's his attraction to Truman, but he's really basically straight. That's kind of like the one link is how straight these later guys were. He was obsessively in love with a guy named Newton. I forget his last name, but he was a major literary critic who wrote like the definitive biographies of Melville and Hawthorne. That was his first love. He basically had three men in his entire life, and each one kind of picked up when the other one, for one reason or another, let him go. And he was obsessively in love with that O'Shea guy who, like, they drove each other to the fucking end of the earth. I mean, he literally hired assassins to chase him down and try to break his legs and scare him. And every time he felt wrong, like, this was his final years were like a million times zanier than even this show indicates. And I wish they got into more of that, because it's just more entertaining than watching everyone die.
What do you think was the intent with the numerous Truman, relatively graphic Truman sex scenes? Because I felt that that was intentionally repulsive gaysploitation, which is good, but like probably pretending to be some kind of like body pause. I mean, it just, it's so horrible to watch that frog face come up from some guy's dick and be like,
was that not the best blowjob you've ever had?
You know, like, no, it wasn't. No, it's so try hard. But I think that that's, like, I can't emphasize how, just how dreadful Answered Prayers actually is and how much I think that the person who wrote that was accurately reflected in this in a somewhat censored manner. Like, you're coming at it from like a position of liking Capote and wanting him defended. I thought the show was good when he was just unquestionably the villain at the beginning, and like, and the good part of the show is the women. Like, the Swans are all amazing performances, and it's something that doesn't come together. But Naomi,
I agree
Watts
about the women. I agree about that.
Naomi Watts is the best thing that she's done since Mulholland Drive, and the best performance she's given. Diane Lane is totally different than she usually is. She's really funny and like extra in this, and I've always thought of her as kind of like a frosty actress, and she's really great. Calista Flockhart looks amazing, looks like Audrey Hepburn. It's really funny. Chloe Sevigny has an unfortunate wig, but she's good.
I love that wig. I love that wig. I want one. I'm glad you brought up the abject sex scenes in this. I feel like this is maybe something that comes from like the Gus Van Sant direction, but it is like the one scene in the second season of The Comeback when Valerie walks in on like Mickey totally undressed in bed with like his enormous white flesh like unspooling over the mattress with like the little Latino like popping up out of it, and it's like a horror movie extension of that over and over again. And I think I'm never going to remove that one shot of Russell Tovey's hand jerking off Truman Capote in the sauna. Like, just the, oh, and that gave me such a spike of terror that I had a nightmare that night about dying alone. So, ew. I'm glad this exists, though. It's like a unique new kind of horror in that aspect. So the show did one innovative new thing. Adam, what did you feel when you saw that?
It's like, oh, shit. Hand job in a sauna.
Would you have let him do it, Adam, if it was you and it was Truman Capote?
No, and I would have let him do it if it was me and Conor McGregor.
No, but wait a minute. Okay, this is a thing. You guys are forgetting. Literally, Truman Capote was, and I'm not actually a Truman Capote fanboy, by the way. I've only literally read In Cold Blood. I haven't even read Breakfast at Tiffany's. I've read In Cold Blood, and I think it's great, but it didn't do anything directly to me as a, like, as a creative inspiration or anything. It didn't rock my world in any way. I just admire it as a work of craft, and as a work of, and as a genre kind of innovation. What I do find the thing I admire most about Truman Capote are his literary judgments and generally his cultural judgments. I think he was like really good and very underrated in that department, and you don't get any of that in this show. This show just presents a fucking disgusting toad.
So what does that have to do with me to get a hand job?
I was going to get there. The hand job. Well, what I'm saying
is, please don't change the subject.
I'm getting back to the hand job that Adam would definitely give Truman Capote. I do not buy this notion.
I'm not impressed by art.
Whatever it is.
I know a lot about art and shit, but
Connor Schmatter.
The only thing that would actually, I would hurdle towards gayness for is like men of physical achievement. So, like, I would let Connor suck me off. I would let Prime Schwarzenegger suck me off. But just like writing good books is like cool, and I'll have a great conversation with you about them, but I don't know if you deserve a hand job over that.
A hand job, which is basically just a literary handshake, it to the man who at the time is literally the only two other people who ever achieved the fame that Truman Capote achieved as a writer in the United States are Mark Twain and Hemingway. That's just consensus. That's not my opinion. So you have to put yourself in the sense that the guy with that level of fame who can get you into the black and white ball or the next one or whatever.
Yeah, that's true.
You're not going to give him a literary handshake. And I don't know. I'm not buying it because we're forgetting just how huge this fucker was and how weird it is that this particular creature is in that pantheon of three people, whoever became that famous. None of the other people we know are anywhere close to as famous. He was like obviously a genius of publicity. He was obviously a kind of founding father of the celebrity culture that eventually engulfed him, that eventually destroyed literary culture to begin with. I mean, what I liked about the first four episodes is how it took me back to that time when there was this happy crossover of all cultural kind of institutions, you know, like movies had been out for decades. TV had been a thing, had already been a thing. Everything was a thing already. All the things that were eventually going to swallow up like high art and high culture and high literature were already out there. But for a brief period of about 20 years, or how, you know, maybe 25, maybe 15, however you want to kind of set it, there was this wonderful confluence where you could be hugely famous for writing a fucking piece in the New Yorker. It would be like talked about everywhere and it'd be sold out everyone. Everyone would know about it. A short story could still be the talk of the town. This book was the event of the, like a worldwide event and a national, like number one story. A writer could be that, a serious writer, not just like a, you know, not just like a pot boiler.
Yeah.
It brings me back to that time. And it's just, to me, it's such a glamorous cultural moment in American history.
Well, you know.
What's that?
We got delicious tacos
That's right.
He's stratospherically famous. Still,
it's not over.
when Delicious Tacos entered in episode 6, that Delicious Tacos character, I was like, this is really, we're fucked. And then it occurred to me that eventually, like, you know, I just started getting mad at Ryan Murphy again. I'm mad at Ryan Murphy, guys. What can I tell you?
This show doesn't have the strong imprint of Ryan Murphy on it.
Yeah.
This is one of the ones that he didn't write or direct. So it really is a different type of thing beyond the signature, pretty universal gay guy interest in glamorous Wikipedia factoids, you know, where people are smoking. Like, this is way more like cobbled together. It feels like, you know, it was all directed by Gus Van Sant except for, I think, two episodes.
Yeah.
And it feels like it were made by separate teams who never communicated and then just pieced together. But I don't think it's way more restrained than almost anything Ryan Murphy. It's way more like conventional. Like this stuff, like the James Baldwin episode is stuff that you see on non-Ryan Murphy, like HBO Max original type shows.
And if I'm not mistaken, Gus Van Sant did not direct the James Baldwin episode. Jennifer Lynch did the absolutely agonizing cancer episode that was very unpleasant. But I don't know who it was.
I felt like I had cancer watching the last four episodes of this fucking series. I did not want to continue. I did not want to. I mean, I saved the last 30 minutes for like today from 3 days ago because I was just
A nap during one of the last episodes at like 3:30 a.m. last night and like woke up with like my laptop like with white light on my face and was like, oh God, where am I? But I think the Ryan Murphy presence here is like kind of this producer role that he takes, and I read like a very short and bland New York Times like profile with him, and he kind of, what he does is when he's writing and directing his own stuff, he makes this sort of format. So then what he does is after he has like the basic rhythm of it, set out, then he can just outsource that, like, that cycle onto other directors and writers and teams. So, like, you can see this with American Horror Story Coven, which he just flatly recycled into the format of Scream Queens that, you know, he had whatever, whoever else do underneath him. And this, like, kind of feels like parts of American Crime Story and parts of the first season of Feud that he's just dumped onto someone else. I think Gus Van Sant does, like, a good job of, like, flailing within, like, the very decided aesthetic parameters they have clearly set up. And he kind of, like, does make it feel like his thing for the first few episodes. But then, as everyone said, it just, like, spirals into chaotic, unglued, gloopy nonsense. But
I'm just annoyed. I have no problems with Gus Van Sant. He also directed the final episode, I noticed.
That's right.
The first four and then the final one.
I've never been a huge Gus Van fan, but I like the aesthetic he cultivated here for the most part.
Oh,
I like the vibe of his. He was a good job.
He did a good job of creating this ambiance of gossip, this aura of gossip, and the way that, that these people are existing in a cloud of gossip. And as Truman Capote once, one of his lines, famous lines, is "All literature is gossip," which prompts us to ask, what is it about, you know, what is it about certain gossip that makes it literature, and what is it about other gossip that makes it poison? But I guess it's in the way you, relate it. And narrativize it. But it wasn't my intention to just bitch about the show, because I did start by liking it. And I was like, I'm glad Truman Capote, I mean, for the same reason that I had just the instinct to want to do an episode about him, despite not having a historical relationship, a personal relationship with that little man who's, speaking of nominal determinism, his original name is Truman Persons. He took up his mom's second husband's name because he was mad at his dad, who was kind of a fraud con man who kept on asking him for money forever. He took on his mom ended up marrying like a Cuban businessman or whatever, Joe Capote. And so, I don't know, somehow Truman Persons Capote is like, you couldn't ask for a better name for the kind of person that Truman was, and the word, just the name Truman, and then the crossover with like Harry Truman in the late 40s when it's crazy. So I read the Gerald Clark famous biography, which was basically Gerald for the biographer. That was like that Truman Capote basically became his personal in cold blood, because he thought he was going to get involved. He was going to get involved for a short, kind of fun biography of this super famous, on top of the world literary star. He ends up chronicling the demise over the course of 13 years that you see depicted in this show. And he ends up, and Truman gave him no strings attached, total access, talked to him constantly, had him in the room all the time. So it was a real, like, you know, it's a really like deep dive biography that he had full access to everything pretty much. It's about ended up being 550 pages. It's really good. It's a real page turner. There's always something a little shallow about biographies to me, no matter how good they are. I feel like when I'm done with them, I feel icky somehow that a life has been, that a life has been truncated to however many pages. I felt the same way after reading the Oscar Wilde biography, but that aside, as biographies go, it's very readable and entertaining, and well written. So I recommend the Gerald Clark biography if you're interested. That's the biography that the Philip Seymour Hoffman movie was based on, although the movie only follows the In Cold Blood adventure, which was Truman's, like, he started out looking for a true crime story to try to do something, you know, report on briefly in a few months for the New Yorker. And immediately realized he had way more on his plate and got super inspired to take on this massive literary experiment. But it became even more massive than he could imagine, because there was appeal after appeal after appeal, and he couldn't put it out until...
Well, and he fell in love with one of the killers.
Yeah, I don't know how much he fell in love with him, but that's... I think
I've thought about this a lot, and I think if you're coming to the point where you're trying... This guy's a killer. Like, this guy murdered a family, as the title says, in cold blood. And if you're making that much attempt to understand him and get the readers to understand him and to turn him into this... Because, you know, the stance he takes in that book is very controversial and, like, slightly on, you know, a libtardy setting, because ultimately he kind of takes the position that this small town community with its conservative strictures on outsider normative behavior is kind of the villain of In Cold Blood. And
so he's the person who started that.
And that's all for the free feed, folks. For the full 3-hour episode, please subscribe to the show at patreon.com/filthyarmenian. And we get really dishy in the second half in honor of Truman Capote and his line, "All literature is gossip." So, yeah, you also get twice as many adventures if you subscribe. You get a dozen smoke break mini eps every month. That's these short 5 to 15, 20 minute episodes I release every few days, reacting to movies, TV shows, weird experiences outside, and all kinds of short subject things. Thank you all for listening. Patreon.com/filthyarmenian. See you on the other side of the paywall.